Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. 12 days that could save humankind. Today, one of the most significant ever summits will get underway in Copenhagen. At stake, the future of this planet we call home. On this week's extended podcast, we look at some of the problems, from the melting of the ice caps.
It is the ultimate warning call to the planet. I mean, the top of the globe turns from a shining cap of white to black water.
To issues facing the developing world.
Literally, people are on the edge in the Sundarbans. And you can't be any more on the edge than this.
Plus, how do we get to a solution?
The two presidents just met behind closed doors. I think they came up with something, but they're not going to reveal what it is until they both go to Copenhagen. If they both turn up in Copenhagen, then they have made a deal.
Is it really all down to the US and China?
The sort of mantra of the Democratic Party and the Obama administration is you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
This is, for them, a way of growing. They think the economic future is going to be a low-carbon future and they want to own it.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. Copenhagen is the new Kyoto, a two-week UN summit on climate change. It's a global problem, which requires a global panel of experts to dissect. Fortunately, that's exactly what we have for you here today. Representing the first and second most polluting countries on Earth, in our Washington, D.C. studio, The Guardian's US environment correspondent, Suzanne Goldenberg. Suzanne, welcome.
Hello, good to be here.
And standing by in China, it's The Guardian's John Watts. John, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Ni hao.
Ranked at number 8 in the world, the UK. Here in London, we've got The Guardian's environment editor, John Vidal.
Hello.
And our guest this week is Alan Anderson. He's a former editor of New Scientist, and he's just also written a book on the Arctic called After the Ice. Welcome, Alan.
Hello. Thank you.
Okay, well, John Vidal, why don't we start with you here in London. Just take us through what the Copenhagen process is all about. Why are we here at this point? Haven't we had endless climate meetings already this year?
This all started 20-odd years ago at Rio de Janeiro at the Earth Summit. It's moved on. This is a semi-permanent meeting of the UN. It involves 180 or more countries, and they have set themselves a target by the end of next Friday week to have come up with a legally binding agreement which will hold emissions to 2 degrees. To a maximum of 2 degrees centigrade higher than they are, and is proving the most contentious meeting there's ever been.
Without wishing to sort of sound negative already, the headlines from the past few weeks have all been saying how Copenhagen's a dead duck, is it?
Now, there's two different things here. The Kyoto Protocol, which is the only legally binding agreement the world has to limit carbon emissions, does look like a dead duck because America and Europe and the rich countries basically do not want it anymore. They say it's flawed and its time has come and it's time to have a new one. The developing countries are absolutely adamant that they will not give this up, that this is the only legally binding agreement they have, and they want to continue it. This is one of the great fault lines in the whole thing. The other issues will be the finance and the emission cuts.
So the idea is to get a legally binding text, which means that from 2012, which is when Kyoto Protocol runs out, from 2012, countries around the world have targets for cutting their greenhouse gas emissions. Alan, take us through some of the science here, actually, because in the time since the Kyoto Protocol was agreed, the science is rapidly advanced and everything's much worse.
Everything is much worse. The computer models are a lot better, though, so we have a lot better idea of just how quickly these changes are going to happen. And if you look back over time, the earlier models gave us a little more time to sort things out, but as conditions have gone on, they've left us less and less time to really deal with the issue. Emissions are growing very much faster than was put into the models, and some things that were left out of the models altogether, like rapidly moving glaciers that raise water levels, just weren't in there because we didn't know about them. The science has really moved on.
All of this is makes the negotiation is much more complicated. So, John, what should we be looking out for? What are the sort of highlights for over the next couple of weeks?
I think all the rich countries are going to have to come up with better emission cuts, offers of cuts. Europe will probably go to 30% cuts on 1990 figures. America, I don't know how much wriggle room. It'd be very interesting to hear from Susie there, how much wriggle room they've given themselves. The other countries will, Russia and so on. We can expect, this is a negotiation, so there will be compromise, there will be changes. And equally, the major emerging countries, China, India, Brazil, Mexico, Indonesia, I think we can probably see some movement there, because at the moment the gap is so far apart. Science says there really has got to be a 40-degree cut in emissions by 2050. At the moment, what the rich countries are offering effectively, depending on whether America is there, is between 15 and 23%. So there's a long, long way to go.
We'll go into the American position in a bit more detail a bit later, but just a bit of a highlight. Suzanne, where does America sort of come into this negotiation? I mean, they've been having all sorts of discussions at home, obviously trying to get legislation through Congress, but how does America present itself on the first day of the conference?
Well, I mean, the highlight for America will be Obama's literally flying visit to the conference in the first week. Now, he's coming in 10 days before the rest of the leaders get here. So he's not going to be negotiating. What he intends is to make a sort of inspirational speech to say, look, we are committed. The George Bush era is behind us. And I can offer somewhere in the range being a critical word, of a 17% cut in emissions from 2005, which, of course, amounts to, just 4 or 6% lower than 1990, the baseline used by the rest of the world. But it's important, the White House thinks, for Obama to be there in person and to show U.S. commitment, because at home, in Congress, the process is paralyzed. You know, there's been various deadlines that have slipped and slipped. They'd hoped to get draft legislation or some kind of version in the Senate to show Copenhagen before the meeting got underway. That's unlikely to happen until January or March.
And John Watts, over there in China, are people optimistic about this process, or do they think it's kind of up to the first world countries to do most of the cutting?
They absolutely believe it's up to the rich countries to shoulder the bulk of the responsibility. That the rich countries have the historical responsibility for the carbon in the air, and that on a per capita basis, that is on the level of the average individual, that rich countries are emitting far more than countries like China. So China will want the US to step up and do more, but it will go into the talks with a promise that it's going to take some share of what needs to be done. It's set its first ever carbon target last week. That's not an overall cut. What they're saying is we're going to continue growing for some considerable time, but what we want to do is slow the growth. We're not going to grow our emissions as fast as we used to do relative to GDP. So please accept that as a big step forward by China.
Okay. Now, before we get onto the political obstacles to reaching agreements on greenhouse gas emissions, let's look at some of the environmental impacts the world already faces, and also some of the science that backs it up.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
The Arctic is one of the Earth's primary indicators of climate change. As the world changes, we tend to see effects there first. Alan Anderson's just written a book about it, so let's go through some of that. Alan, what's happened to the Arctic that we've sort of noticed in the past couple of decades?
Well, it's really the biggest and fastest change of the planet ever made by human beings. The summer ice is simply disappearing. So compared to only a decade or so ago, the summer ice, an area 10 times the size of the whole of Great Britain of extra ice, is melting away each summer. Colossal area is vanishing. And to my mind, this is not only, you know, a dramatic change to the Arctic and for the people of the Arctic and also the animals and so on that live there, but it is the ultimate warning call to the planet. I mean, the top of the globe turns from a shining cap of white to black water. What more dramatic message could there be to everybody else that something major is happening?
I mean, a whole set of issues come about because of this. I mean, the idea of the ice disappearing completely implies that different countries will try and take mineral rights up there. And this is one of the issues that climate change is bringing. It's that there are potentially wars, there are potentially resource issues. I mean, what's happening on that front in the Arctic?
Well, that'll all happen a little more slowly because people try to dramatize it will happen tomorrow. But the first thing we want to know is how fast will the ice go completely? Some people now think 2013 because the ice is growing much thinner as well as growing smaller in area. So if it's gone by 2013, that is far too quick for nations to react and bring in the rules that we need to govern a new Arctic. And there will be a squabble for resources. There will be ships going straight across there. Currently, a ship can go through there without any special oil spill protection. It can run into ice and ruin the Arctic. So if it happens fast, we're in deep trouble.
And what about wildlife there? The iconic pictures of polar bears sort of on bits of ice that are melting.
Bluntly, they're all going to go. The polar bear, the narwhal, and other really iconic creatures of the Arctic are all totally dependent on ice. And the polar bear also lives by hunting seals, which are themselves dependent on ice. So they're all going to go. And the recent estimates is we've got until really 2050 before polar bears are just left in a few corners of the Arctic. And in the new open sea that will be the Arctic instead of the ice Arctic, there'll be a new symbolic predator. And that's going to be the orca, the killer whale. So instead of seeing the polar bear on the ice, we'll see the fin of the killer whale. And to my mind, that's a terrible change.
Is the Arctic now just a sort of canary? We can't do anything about it. It's gone.
Yes.
There's nothing at all we can do to reverse any of this.
We would have to make such dramatic cuts. They go well beyond the cuts that you've been talking about as hoped for, which we don't seem to be able to get to. So the ice is going to go. The feedback loop has started. Once black turns to white, it soaks up more heat and it continues. So the concern now is, as you say, with a race for resources, with oil and gas being found there, with ships moving in there, how are we to make sure there isn't a double wave of environmental damage? Pirate fishermen moving in. The fish are moving north already. Southern fish, great fish to catch. And the fishermen will be going after them at great speed if we don't move quickly.
Okay, well, Alan's book, After the Ice, is out now. And Alan's going to stay with us to give us his thoughts on some of the other issues in the podcast. On to the developing countries now. John Vidal's been on a bit of a mission to the Indian subcontinent. Before he tells us about it, let's hear from some of the people who live with some of the very real effects of climate change.
My name is Dao Stephen Sherpa. I'm from Nepal. I come from the high Himalayas. My family's from the Everest region itself, and within the last few generations since my grandfather's time, we've seen a lot of changes in the Himalayas, especially the melting of the glaciers. I can remember from my childhood when the glaciers were much lower, and if you look at it now, the glaciers have receded so far up the mountain, it's quite astonishing. We know also that it was much lower because you had climbers actually going ice climbing there. I myself am a mountaineer, so I remember that you could go ice climbing on many of these routes. But now, you can't go ice climbing there anymore because there is no more ice. Also, there's changes in the weather patterns, and that means that we don't have enough rain when it should rain, and when it does rain, it rains too much. And it's causing problems not only for the wildlife, but also for the local people.
Anurag Danda. I work for WWF in the Sundarbans. Over the past two decades, what people are experiencing is loss of land that results in physical displacement. It also results in displacement in livelihood pattern. And therefore, it is physical security that is threatened. It is socioeconomic security that is threatened.
How close are people to the sea now? I mean, the people their homes are threatened. You talked about migrants, you talked about a catastrophe.
Literally, people are on the edge in the Sundarbans. And you can't be any more on the edge than this. And Sundarbans could be the miner's canary for the rest of the world.
It's the equivalent of the Maldives, but in India.
Yes, and much bigger in terms of population.
Hundreds of thousands of people who are at an imminent risk of being made climate refugees.
Yes, undoubtedly. The population of the Sundarbans only in India is over 4.5 million. With a population density of about 1,000 people per square kilometer. So every square kilometer lost displaces 1,000 people.
Are people moving already?
Yes, they are. They've moved from one island to another. They've moved from the island to the other places. There are families who have become destitute simply because they do not have the capacity to participate in a different setting.
What else? What do you think governments should do about this?
One is the mitigation aspect of it. But as science says, even if the mitigation were to start tomorrow, it would be another 100 years. Sundarbans and its people do not have 100 years. And therefore, adaptation in terms of physical security, in terms of livelihood security, is an issue here and now for the people of Sundarbans.
So, John, tell us where you've been.
Well, it was a bit of a climate journey. I started up on the glaciers in the Himalayas and headed down the rivers as far as the Bay of Bengal, India, and Bangladesh. And what we found was it was pretty depressing, frankly. I mean, what's happening in the Himalayas are heating up, maybe Nepal is heating up twice as fast as most other countries. The Himalayas itself is heating up twice as fast as that. In some places, already 4 degrees centigrade above normal. It's on course to be 8 degrees centigrade above. Now, if that happens, the scale of the devastation downstream is just unbelievable, because the Himalayas provides the water and the sustenance, effectively, for 1.3 billion people. And Nepal alone, 700 million people depend on the rivers which come off the Himalayas. Last year, they had no snow. We went up to 17,000 feet. There was no snow. And it was terrifying. Yet downstream, because the climate seems to be in a sort of totally different order now, we found great floods and droughts in Bihar. And then in Bangladesh, it was a terrifying scenario where the cyclones are getting stronger and more frequent, and the sea level is rising. That was pretty well documented by some extremely good scientists there.
Alan, once the glaciers around the Himalayas go, I mean, that we're already down to sort of scary levels.
We are, and there's an interesting twist to that, which I think John is also very interested in, that black carbon smoke from cooking fires is landing on the ice up there and helping to speed its melt even further. And that's happening very much in the Arctic. The whole Arctic is being blanketed in industrial pollution from further south, and that's helping to heat up the snow and melt it away. And I have a long-shot hope that at COP there might be some action to halt that kind of air pollution, because it's a very quick breathing space for us. You know, the pollution disappears very quickly and would give a brief spurt of hope.
Well, one of the people that John spoke to in Bangladesh was Salim Ul Huq, head of climate change at the International Institute of Environment and Development. John, you spoke to him about the gulf between the US and the poorer G77 countries.
He's one of the world's great optimists, and he believes there is a rational answer to this, and he is the world's greatest hope. He's a sort of brilliant Bangladeshi scientist who's actually also advising Bangladesh government and others. I think the feeling you got from talking to him was that there is hope. We know what needs to be done. Well, let's go and do it. And his appeal was very much to the world leaders to, you know, bang their heads together, come up with something fast.
I don't think they're that far apart. The United States wants developing countries to take action. Brazil has just declared a goal for 30% reduction. Indonesia has just declared a goal for 30% reduction. So developing countries are coming forward. They're doing what the US wants them to do.
What about the least developed countries and the Africa group? Do you think they will see a good result from it?
Well, they seem to be getting their act together better now. They are trying to throw their weight around and trying to have their voices heard. I'm not quite sure what they'll get out of it in terms of mitigation targets. They're not a player there. It's between China and the US to boil it down to its essentials. And the two presidents just met behind closed doors. I think they came up with something, but they're not going to reveal what it is until they both go to Copenhagen. If they both turn up in Copenhagen, then they have made a deal, I think, in my view.
Is it more important that America gets on board than anything else?
I think it's very important psychologically for the rest of the world, because they've been such a block. They have actually held back the world for the last 10 years under Bush. They've made us go backwards. So, you know, they have a lot of catching up to do to reclaim any sense of leadership in this area, and we hope that they will.
That was Salim Ul Huq talking to The Guardian's environment editor, John Vidal. You can watch a video of John's travels at guardian.co.uk/video. And while we're on the subject of videos on Copenhagen, you can send us a video message. The best ones will be played out in The Guardian's website. All the details are at guardian.co.uk/Copenhagen.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Let's move on to some solutions now. First, the former biggest polluter in the world, the United States. Suzanne Goldenberg's been tracking the mood in Washington for The Guardian for the past year and a half. Before we get to that, though, Suzanne, you've been having a rather interesting chat with one of the big names in the world of climate science.
Yes, Jim Hansen. He's basically the man who alerted the world to climate change, or the politicians anyway, about 20 years ago now, when he testified before Congress on the sort of gathering danger of climate change. And he said then, you know, two decades ago, that people needed to act very quickly.
And he's been speaking about whether there should be a deal at Copenhagen or not. And, I mean, he's not positive about it.
No, he isn't. I mean, he's a very interesting man. He's very understated. He's very soft-spoken. But he is really vociferous on this issue that the cap-and-trade strategy, which is a sort of mainstream approach for dealing with climate change, and which is going to be the basic architecture of the deal, or an eventual deal, that'll come out of these negotiations, that in his view, that is not the right way to go about it. He does not believe that that will succeed in actually cutting global emissions. And he points out quite rightly that since Kyoto, actually, global emissions have risen. They've gone down in some countries and up in others. And his solution is just to put a tax on the price of any fossil fuel, on carbon, you know, right at the mine where the coal comes out of, right at the port where the oil is imported.
The approach that's being talked about is so fundamentally wrong. I think it's just as well that we not have a substantive treaty. Because if it's going to be the Kyoto-type thing and people agree to that, then they'll spend years trying to determine exactly what that means and what is the commitment, what are the mechanisms. The whole idea that you have goals which you're supposed to try to meet, and that you have outs with offsets, means that it's an attempt to continue business as usual. And as I mentioned in the book, this is analogous to the indulgences that the Catholic Church sold in the Middle Ages, which is an excellent solution for both the church. The bishops collected lots of money, and the sinners got redemption so they could still go to heaven. Both parties liked that arrangement, despite its absurdity. For us to put that burden on our children and grandchildren, knowing the situation, is a moral issue. And in a sense, this is analogous to the issue of slavery faced by Abraham Lincoln, or the issue of Nazism faced by Winston Churchill. And there you had a leader who would recognize the problem. And on those kind of issues, you cannot compromise. You can't say, let's reduce slavery, let's find a compromise, reduce it 50%, or reduce it 40%, or 60%. He couldn't do that. And that's why it was such a difficult thing and resulted in such enormous human tragedy in the United States, more deaths than any prior war. I'm disappointed that the Democratic Party is not able to rise above the minority of anti-nukes. So it's really a terrible shame that in 1994 Clinton terminated that R&D, because we could have had functioning fourth generation nuclear power now. But it was the caving in to this small, very vocal anti-nuclear segment. You know, it was people who grew up in the 1970 era, at the time of the Three Mile Island thing and Jane Fonda and things, and it was proper to put a stop on any further nuclear development until that was really looked at carefully.
Jim Hansen there. I don't want to dwell on him too much, but Alan, what's your call on Jim Hansen's sort of pessimism? And when he compares climate change to slavery and saying you can't reduce this by 40 or 50%, you have to get rid of it all, that's a compelling argument.
Well, he's dead right. You can't negotiate with the planet. You can't negotiate with physics. And I think a lot of politicians still think that you can. So in that, he's absolutely 100% correct. But Jim doesn't always carry the whole scientific community with him, simply because, although he's a great scientist, he does take political and iconoclastic views such as this view that we should sort of restart the whole negotiations on another principle now, which is not going to happen. So a lot of scientists tend to keep a little bit of a distance from Jim simply because of that.
Suzanne, how have Jim Hansen's comments been taken there in the States?
He is breeding resentment, as Alan says, among environmentalists and among scientists, because he's seen as a bit of a spoiler for a process that's underway. You know, the sort of mantra of the Democratic Party and Obama administration is on every issue, not just this, is you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, or vice versa. And they sort of say, look, this is the best we can hope for. We should go with that. There's also resentment of Hansen because, you know, he's talking about economics here when he's talking about cap and trade, and he's a scientist. But for the young people, he's a hero because he's been going out there and he's actually, you know, he got himself arrested at a demonstration against coal, mountaintop mining removal. And that's a huge issue here among young people. So he does have the support of a younger generation.
More generally in America, though, what we hinted earlier about the position that America's going to come to the talks with. But at home, how is the debate going down in Congress?
Well, I'll get to that in just one second. I want to preface this, but, you know, every day practically there's new polls out showing that, you know, the American people are still not focused on this issue and they don't know what's going to be happening in Copenhagen over the next couple of weeks. That being said, you know, John Kerry, who's the head of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, has all but conceded, you know, a failure that, you know, he wasn't able to get a draft agreement out or sort of a draft vision of what a cap and trade bill would look like before this meeting gets underway. And, you know, now there's a real fear that this issue of climate change and energy is going to keep getting pushed further and further down the list of priorities for the Obama administration. It's clear Obama is focused on health care. It's clear that he's focused on the economy. He's been focused on Afghanistan. This is sort of being pushed down the list, and it's a controversial issue, which means that with midterm elections coming up in November 2010, the members of Congress aren't going to want to take this up. So the further down the list it gets, the further back in the calendar, the less of a chance of them actually moving to try and pass legislation on greenhouse gas emissions, even in 2010, let alone before this meeting.
How much do the appeals of developing nations or others make an impact on American politics? I mean, you heard Salim al-Huk there saying that unless the U.S. gets on board with the deal, then psychologically it might not be so great.
Oh, that's virtually nothing. I think the big key here is, and what people in Congress are looking for and what they say all the time is, what are India and China doing? So their big concern is that the U.S. should not be the only country acting. I mean, that's the argument of the naysayers, that they have to see India and China moving to cut their emissions. And then, you know, the U.S. can act. Because within Congress, it's been seen very much as an issue of global competitiveness, that they don't want to make their industries weaker against, you know, Chinese and Indian competition. So they're looking at the more rapidly emerging economies. The sort of moral argument doesn't carry any weight here, really.
John Vidal, just quickly, the Britain talks a big game about its own carbon reduction targets and on climate change. Can we do anything here influence the Americans on this?
Well, even our climate secretary, Mr. Miliband, was talking about Britain going up to 42% from a 34% cut by 2020, which is actually very, very ambitious. It would be the most ambitious in the world, I think, even after Norway. Europe can go up to 30%. There's a lot of wriggle room. I mean, everyone's agreed that where you've got to be at 2050, it's only a midterm target. And frankly, most of these politicians are not going to be around in a few years' time. There's a lot of people upset about the United States, because every country has got problems with its own legislatures and MPs and positions, and every country has to sell it back to its own people. And we've just seen in Australia they're having terrible problems there. And the feeling is that America is, well, you know, you are the biggest, or it is the biggest emitter. Coming up with a 4%, 5% effective cut is a bit of an insult. And when you talk to the people from Ghana and Uganda and Nepal and whatever, they just think, well, you know, what's going on? Why has America got to be like this? So we are, I mean, there's a huge sort of a well of distrust about the rich countries at the moment.
Okay, on to China now. The government there has just announced a target to reduce its carbon intensity.
I think you failed to get my point. Actually, we are not setting a lower target, we are setting a higher target, because it is even more difficult for us to achieve this target, and we will pay a higher price to achieve this target. We will have to adopt more proactive measures to meet this target.
John, what's the take us through what the Chinese government announced. What are their targets now coming into Copenhagen?
China announced its first ever carbon target, but it wasn't a carbon cut. It was a reduction in carbon intensity. And what that means is that basically carbon emissions are going to continue to grow, but China is promising that they will grow more slowly. And the target it has given is that between 2005 and 2020, China's carbon intensity will fall by between 40 to 45%. What that means is that if China's economy continues to grow, as it has done for much of the last 30 years by more than 8%, then the amount of carbon released into the air in that period will still increase by 70 to 90, 100%. So this is their big promise. Them saying, we've signed up. We're doing the carbon thing now. We're going to also move in a big way into renewables. We promised that by 2020, 15% of our energy will come from solar power and wind power and other renewable forms. And we're also on a massive afforestation program. China is doing something, and just as in Susie's case, they're not doing it because of the moral argument. They're doing it because this is for them a way of growing. They think the economic future is going to be a low carbon future, and they want to own it.
Using parallels there again with the states internally in the country, has the government had to sell this to businesses or to its population, or is it just setting targets and letting people get on with it?
Well, they don't have the problems of a democracy that Susie has mentioned. Once once the Chinese government decides something, it gets done. It goes through the legislature, which is basically a rubber stamp legislature. But that said, they do have to keep business on side. They do have to ensure that this will not constrain Chinese growth. So the way they've try to sell it is to say that look, we're all gonna get richer off of this. That we will get more energy security, we'll be less dependent on oil imports, and we're gonna have huge business because we're gonna make more solar panels than anyone else. We're gonna make more electric cars than anyone else, and we're gonna be the wind power capital of the world. So this is a power play.
Suzanne, when Obama made his announcement that he was going to fly to Copenhagen next at the beginning of the talks, he was in a sort of middle of these conversations with the premiers of China and India. How important are those two countries to what the US ends up doing?
Well, I think it's crucial. I think he needed to have those back-to-back meetings with the leaders of India and China and to get commitments from them before he could come out with his own commitment. And you could still see some nervousness from the White House about that because they made the announcement the day before the Thanksgiving holiday, i.e. they didn't want anyone to pay attention to it. I wanted to pick up on a point that John made that is a crucial part of the argument here, and that's that the White House and supporters of climate change legislation have been really pushing away at the line that, you know, this is America's future, that there's tremendous economic opportunity here. And part of that argument is saying, look, China is sort of moving ahead. We have to catch up. We can't be left behind. So I think that is the area where America, you know, could be prodded into action. It's, you know, the economic opportunity, the need not to be outpaced by China and India in this area.
Alan, you were nodding your head there.
Yeah, there is an interesting twist to this that, of course, if you tie carbon intensity to growth rates, making your economy more efficient tends to drive a higher growth rate. So you often end up with pumping out just as much carbon. You're just doing it with more efficient energy technologies. So it's a dodgy business, this kind of argument.
Can anyone say anything about the idea of one of the other things that are going to be talked about at the Copenhagen meeting, which is this idea of technology transfer, that if the richer countries want the developing world to come on board, that they're going to have to pay for this somehow? Now, we've heard about clean development mechanisms in the past, but technology transfer seems to be something that is coming along at the center of this as well. I mean, John, what do the developing countries kind of want from the richer nations?
This is the one thing which I think is quite likely to come well out of the talks. They've got a long way with the negotiations. The world leaders should easily be able to stitch up a deal. Effectively, what America is proposing is a group of research stations around the world which will disseminate best practice to individual countries on a sort of loan basis or whatever, without intellectual property rights getting... real progress has been made here. The irony of the whole thing now is that the technology is now... It used to be a debate, well, how can the poor countries get the technology of the rich? And now it's actually working the other way. Countries like China and India are actually developing the technology much, much faster than in the West, and somehow some of the rich countries actually want access to that technology.
Is there also an argument to be made that there's no point just selling someone some technology? You've got to train the people there to build their own technology and develop their own things. I mean, I'm talking about Africa here, for example. China seems to be a special case on that front, developing its own, but Africa and other places, there's no point just selling them a nuclear power station or a wind farm. Someone needs to be there to administer this stuff as well.
No, that's a big thing, and it's linked obviously to money and real cash transfers. I think nuclear power is the one area in technology terms which is going to come out of this in a very, very big way. I mean, there's 25 countries in the world which we know of which are pressing for nuclear power, and part of their deal is an answer to climate change. Whether or not you agree with that is another matter, but technology...
You don't agree with that.
I have problems there, but Mr. Hansen
and Mr. Lovelock also seem to sort of disagree with you.
And I wonder what all those youthful followers of Jim Hansen who applaud him being arrested think about his views on nuclear power. Is there a little gap there?
It's a huge gap, and it's one, you know, the nuclear issue. Well, I want to go back to a point that was made earlier. And while the, you know, Congress and the administration here are paralyzed, in the business community, there's a lot of stuff going on. And, there is growth in these areas, and in the American business sees opportunity here. Also, in terms of using its regulatory powers, the Obama administration is doing it what it can in the absence of legislation to sort of move things along, you know, to encourage, you know, lower emission stuff, so that there has been, you know, new auto emission standards brought in. There's financial incentives given to people who want to sort of reduce their energy use at their house. You know, there's regulations coming in California, which will, you know, impose more energy efficient standards on flat screen TVs, you know, which have become a big creator of greenhouse gas emissions, or now seeing as that. But on the nuclear issue, I think that is actually going to be crucial in terms of getting a deal in Congress, because Republicans want to build lots and lots of nuclear power plants. And if the Democrats can agree to that, then I think you'll actually get climate change legislation here. So that may be the thing that the sort of left and the youthful environmentalists and traditional environmentalists will have to accept, that nuclear power is going to be a piece of the solution. Not James Hansen doesn't think it's a main piece. I mean, he's adamant, you know, first energy efficiency, then use of renewables. But nuclear comes in on number three at his list.
Science Weekly.
Before we wind up this podcast, I just want to go around our panelists one more time and just ask, what does a successful result from this summit look like? Alan, let's start with you. Well, what does a successful result look like from this summit?
Well, at this stage, it's really a kind of framework agreement, but we must have the impetus to then do something with that framework over the next few years. And I'd love to see some action on this air pollution that is heating the planet, because it might give us a two-year break to sort things out a little bit better.
John Watts, what does a successful Copenhagen look like for China?
I think Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabao will go to Copenhagen with a considerable degree of confidence that the developing world has rallied together pretty well, that they're in a strong moral position, in that they've been asked to set targets, not internationally binding targets, but to set their own action plans, and most of them have done so. We've seen Brazil, we've seen China, and most recently India, all set targets on slowing the rate at which their emissions will rise. And China, of course, has set its first carbon target. This will give them some confidence, and they will be able to claim the high moral ground, particularly when it comes to negotiations with the United States, which is seen much more of as an obstacle and a country that has dragged its feet for a long time. But at the same time, there will be a lot of unease in China and other developing countries about suggestions that this meeting should just come up with a political statement rather than a legally binding statement. Developing countries have made it very clear that what they want is a legally binding treaty that is a successor to Kyoto, and it doesn't look like that's what they're going to be given. So it's quite possible we'll see some friction on that front.
And Suzanne, if it's possible to work out what a successful deal is for the U.S., what would it be?
It's got to be something that would make it easier for Obama to get climate change legislation through Congress. The U.S. public can't look at Copenhagen and say, oh, we're getting ganged up on. Whatever happens in Copenhagen from the Obama administration's point of view has to somehow make it easier to get climate change law through Congress.
John, what's a successful deal for you?
2 degrees centigrade, that's as simple as that. That's the only deal which is going to be successful in the long run. The way things are looking, I think, at the moment, is there will be 100 leaders and there will be a great testosterone-fueled finish at the end, and everyone will bash everybody's heads together and they will come out clutching some paper. It may be a rather weak deal. That's the danger. And then it just goes into interminable talks over another year, over money, over forests, over all the details which they won't work out.
How optimistic are you? I mean, you've covered this subject for more than two decades. How optimistic are you that we're going to get somewhere?
We will get somewhere. It just won't be as far and as fast as we want.
Alan?
I think there is going to be a joker in the pack, because going back to my Arctic, I think over the next few years, it's truly going to disappear. And the power of that message is going to be so great that we will see that action moving forward and get to that 2 degrees that is so important.
Okay, well, we'll finish there. Our thanks to John Watts in China, Suzanne Goldenberg in the US, and John Vidal here in London. All three of them will be reporting from the summit in Copenhagen as it unfurls over the next 2 weeks. Thanks too to Alan Anderson. His book, After the Ice, is out now. For more on all of this, you can go to environmentguardian.co.uk. There you'll find blogs and comment from a range of voices at the talks. There's video, audio, and a whole bunch of background guides and data to help you get a handle on what's going on. If you want regular email updates too, sign up at guardian.co.uk/greenlight. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. On the next Science Weekly podcast, comedian Robin Ince is in the studio to tell us about this year's 9 Lessons and Carols for Godless People. We'll no doubt be covering some of the first week's developments in Copenhagen too. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.